You're listening to Chaos on the Set, a chaotic TV and film review podcast, and in honor of spooky season, we are covering the scariest movie I would agree to watch this month, which is Silence of the Lambs. It's me and Mike today because Kate would definitely not agree to watch Silence of the Lambs, but we have our own horror expert here joining us. Asia, thank you for joining us to discuss Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, happy to be here.
I know that your childhood was at a too early age affected by Silence of the Lambs to the point that it affected your college major. Can you shed us some insight on that?
Yeah, so I majored in psychology and film. Mostly because I did grow up watching a lot of psychological thrillers, Silence of the Lambs being one of them, probably one of my favorites of them, and so that's what I decided I wanted to do with my life.
Did Silence of the Lambs ever come up in any of your psych classes?
No, actually.
It did come up in a lot of my film classes, which is funny because that's how I first experienced Silence of the Lambs. But before I jump into my backstory, Mike, what is your relationship with Silence of the Lambs?
So, like so many things in my life, my relation to the Silence of the Lambs starts with The Office, actually.
Ooh.
And the infamous CPR scene when Dwight cuts the face off of the dummy. Much like Hannibal Lecter does with a real man. And, you know, being a super fan of The Office and that being one of the greatest episodes ever in the show, for years and years after seeing it, me and my brother would quote Dwight in that scene just where he goes Clarice, like he does the voice and turns around with the mask. So we've been saying like Clarice for years without even really knowing the full context behind all of it. And then I watched The Silence of the Lambs for the first time 2 or 3 years ago on my birthday, actually, believe it or not. Like, that was
what a choice.
That's a little weird, Mike.
No, we were well, my birthday's in June.
Does that make it better?
We were having no, but it, hear me out here. We were having like an outdoor movie night, right. and so I wanted to watch Silence of the Lambs, and I made everybody watch it. And it has quickly become one of my favorites. I've probably rewatched it like 5 or 6 times since then. Yeah, I love it. So I don't know what that says about me, but
I do think Silence of the Lambs makes a good outdoor movie because it's under 2 hours. You know what I mean? So
just
it's like
barely.
A nice, yeah, but still, you know what I mean? It's, I would say if this movie was made today, it would be 2.5 hours easily.
Yeah.
Also a big part of me saying, yeah, I'll watch it is because it was under 2 hours.
Funny enough though, I will say even knowing like years later that the face thing was a reference to Silence of the Lambs, like I was still surprised by it the first time I saw it because I didn't know when exactly it was going to happen and I kind of forgot that it was going to happen. And then like when it does happen, I was like, fuck yes, it's happening.
Mike, you're a little twisted. I mean, I guess I already knew that.
Yeah.
I am not twisted at all. I am so pure. No, I'm kidding. But I literally am so, I would say, easily freaked out that I remember sophomore or junior year of college, a friend was watching Silence of the Lambs and she had posted on her Instagram story the it puts the lotion in the basket scene. You know how sometimes people just like film what they're watching,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's like an iconic scene. But to me, my first time watching it was watching her Instagram story, and it horrified me just like casually sitting on the toilet watching Instagram, like, nope, never watching that movie. And so literally that weekend, I was like, I just saw something that freaked me out. I'm curious to know more, but I'm never watching this movie. So I read the whole synopsis to Silence of the Lambs. Fast forward to 2 years, or I guess, what, 6 years later, this weekend, when we finally sit down to watch Silence of the Lambs, and I knew the plot in the back of my head, and I've seen in our directing or like our TV film production class, they showed us the final scene in Buffalo Bill's, like that escape, because it is like you watch that scene and you can see, okay, yeah, this should be taught in classes to just understand suspense and shooting all of that. So I knew a lot of little itty bitty backstories going into watching the movie. That said, it still thoroughly entertained me. You know, I was definitely shocked by the wearing the face scene. I guess my only thing is, like, it really doesn't feel like a horror movie. It doesn't feel as scary as I was so resistant to watching it for. I would say that It Puts Lotion on the Basket scene is just the worst scene of them all.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think it's more creepy than it is horrific. That being said, I don't know. I can imagine, like, watching this in a dark theater in the 90s and being kind of horrified by it. And you brought up a good point there, is, and I'm so, like, interested that you read the synopsis, like, years before and then watch it.
I do commonly read the synopses for horror movies, because especially, like, new ones, like, what was that M. Night Shyamalan movie that everyone was talking about?
Where Cabin.
Yeah.
Knock at the Cabin.
Everyone was talking about it. I was like, I want to be part of the conversation. So I'll just, like, read the synopsis and then I know what people are talking about.
Yeah. But, you know, for me, having rewatched it so many times, like, I still, like, I've heard people say, like, oh, it loses a bit on a rewatch because you lose the suspense aspect of it. But I mean, for me, it's always just as thrilling. And I think what's so powerful about the film is really more so the characters and the deeply psychological nature to it, which I'm sure Asia can speak to much better than I can. That's what always draws me back to it personally.
Yeah, I feel like for me, like, I think this was my first time, like, watching it as an adult, ironically. And so I feel like, and the rewatch, there were a lot of things that I forgot, but, like, then there were a lot of things that, like, came back to my, like, memory as I was watching it. And I think, like, it's definitely a movie that I feel like moving forward, I probably rewatch a lot more frequently, just because I feel like there are a lot of, like, elements to it that do make it interesting to continue to watch and, like, watch again, that you can, like, you can lean into, like, how the acting is so great. You can lean into certain, like, cinematic choices and, like, the story,
like,
can just
the
come
production
out.
Design alone. Yeah. Like, the cage that they build for Hannibal, when, like, you can tell, like, they built the bars to be very far apart from each other so you can see their face and their eyes when Clarice and Hannibal are talking to each other. But, no, I can definitely, peeling through each element of it would give you more on rewatch. One thing that we realized that we didn't talk about much, or something that didn't strike itself out enough to even make it to our podcast outline until right before we started recording, Asia made a joke about cannibalism, and I realized that cannibalism wasn't even in our podcast outline, and I feel like it's because at the time, cannibalism must have been so much more of a terrifying concept, but now we've had, like, Yellow Jackets. It was spoilers for The Last of Us, but it's in an element of a small episode of The Last of Us, you know. I don't know. I feel like we've seen it.
There's also been, like, a couple movies in, like, the past 2 years.
Yeah, it's, like, just, like, less...
Bones and All.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, Bones and All made cannibalism romantic.
There's, like, a Hulu
Prey? Or no, yeah. Not Prey. The Sebastian Stan one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I mean, I will say, I remember as a kid, cannibalism being one of those irrational fears, like quicksand, where it's just like, I don't know why, but I just remember.
What if somebody eats me?
Yeah, literally. And real quick, just because you mentioned it a minute ago, I hate to go back, but speaking of the production design, I watched a lot of it. Sort of jogged my memory. I watched all of the DVD extras on the Criterion disc, which are great. And we'll get into a lot of the deleted scenes later on in the podcast. It's a big part of it. But there's just so many interviews between the cast and the crew. And I loved that particular tidbit they had in there about, like, they went back and forth the longest time about, should the bars be this wide, right? Because it's not just about filming him. Obviously, like, you want to see his face, but also, like, he's a cannibal. Like, you can't let him get his arms, like, outside of these bars, you know? And, like, just that epiphany that they had in the production design to make it a glass wall, then obviously had to drill all the little holes in it for the sound design aspect of it. But it's all those little details
and
about...
then with the glass, so you can see Clarice and then Hannibal's reflection in the glass, so you're seeing both of them.
Exactly, and it's like, so there's so much layers, I feel like, to the production design and the way they shot it that plays into the psyche of these characters and who they are, right? I mean, so many shots where they're staring directly into the camera, and sometimes there's not even an actor on the other side of it, even though that's like how it's portrayed in the film. So,
which, by the way, I was listening to a podcast with an actor on it talking about how they filmed it with looking in the camera or looking, you know, with no actor on the other side. And he was like, that is really hard. It's so difficult to act alongside a machine when you're so used to acting alongside people. So just like extra props to Hopkins and Foster for, you know, really killing it and getting the Oscar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, interestingly enough, Hannibal Lecter is listed as the number one villain on AFI's 100 Years of Heroes and Villains list, which I thought was really interesting because after watching this movie, I don't feel like Hannibal is a villain. Like, yes, he's a cannibal and he's scary, but I mean, I guess in my head, villain equates to antagonist, and antagonist is somebody who's getting in the way of our protagonist from getting their goal. And Hannibal, if anything, is helping our protagonist get to her goal. So, yes, he's scary, and I guess that contributes to him being a villain, but I don't know. How do y'all feel about him as a villain?
Yeah, it's a very interesting scenario, right, where you have two villains, essentially, between him and Buffalo Bill, that are sort of counteracting each other. But I will say, although he's not an antagonist to Clarice, because there's, I think, a lot of, you know, mutual respect there. Like, they have this deep understanding and he sees something in her. Really, like, he is teaching her, essentially, how to do her job, how to profile. He's giving her better training than the FBI ever could, essentially. But you do see him act as an antagonist basically to every other person in the film, other than Barney, maybe, because they're kind of pals. But, you know, Dr. Chilton, the senator, you know, everybody else in the film, he really is, I think, the antagonist and just emblematic of this pure evil. And there's sort of like, I don't know, I feel like there's no line he really won't cross when it comes to tormenting. And sometimes he just toys with these people for his own amusement, like multiple MIGs. I mean, he talked him into choking on his own tongue. How do you do that? I don't know.
Yeah, he definitely, like, maybe not to Clarice he wasn't a villain, but, like, to everyone else, like, they were terrified of him. And she might have been, like, a little scared at first, but then I feel like that kind of quickly goes away where she's kind of like, you're not going to, like, have this power over me the way that you have this power over everyone else. And I think that does play a part in their, like, dynamic with each other. But yeah, like, it is surprising that he's number one, because, like,
right? Do you guys want to guess who the other ones are?
Well, I saw the list.
Oh, damn. Okay, Mike, do you want to guess?
Sure.
I do have comments on the rest, on the, like, the top five.
Greatest villains is the Joker one. Heath Ledger's Joker is that one.
They're all really old, I should say.
I figured they would be.
They're all, the top five are all from the 1900s.
Can you give me a hint?
I wonder if this, I think this list is, it looks like this list is, oh wait, no, there's one from 2001. So I think.
So currently it'd probably be a lot different.
Yeah. Oh, this is probably, this list probably came out in 2001 when the last AFI list came out.
Okay, just name them. I'm not going to guess.
It's Norman Bates, Darth Vader, the Wicked Witch of the West. And then the last one is from Nurse Ratched from
So fascinating, because they're all extremely different. Norman Bates, I mean, obviously Norman Bates is actually a pretty interesting comparison, because he's actually similar to the Buffalo Bill character in a way.
That's my immediate thought when I was like watching the movie. I was like, oh.
Wait, how? I haven't seen it.
So like in Psycho, essentially Norman like takes on this persona of like his mother. Ooh. And like, you know,
and wears her clothes
and stuff like that. So like when Buffalo Bill is like trying to turn these girls into a human skin suit, it's very like reminiscent of that like theme.
Interesting. I do want to get more into the Buffalo Bill of it all before we move on from Hannibal. I just want to ask psychology major Asia Lance. Oh, sorry, I just doxed you. we do that often on this podcast. is it possible to talk somebody into swallowing their own tongue, or?
I think that's definitely like a stretch. Okay. I feel like that's more so the film trying to like be like, this man is a psychologist, like he knows how to get into your head. Yeah. And like all this stuff. I mean, that's definitely not something we're taught in psychology classes. But I can see in this like world of, you know, a cannibalistic serial killer in a film, you're mm-hmm. trying to give him the power to like be so manipulative and get inside your head that he can like talk you into getting something. But also, what's Migs?
Yeah.
He had his own issues that he probably was very easy to like manipulate.
I just feel like
he probably just like triggered some schizophrenia or something that like,
yeah. I'm not saying that Hannibal is not scary. He's obviously scary, and Anthony Hopkins, but I think it's so much because of Anthony Hopkins' performance, because it's like they tell you he talked Migs into doing this. They tell you don't get too close to him. They, you know, it's all the audience telling Clarice things of his power, but you don't really do we ever actually get to see him talk or manipulate that much? I think the way he gets out of jail is very
but we
brilliant,
do get to I was going to say, yeah, we get to see him bite a guy's face and cut it off and wear it. I mean, that okay, was pretty
Valley, yeah.
Yeah. I will say, like, I think in some of the other films also starring Anthony Hopkins, he's a bit more maniacal, particularly the prequel, because he's not in jail yet. So you see him, like, spoiler alert, which I'm sure you won't watch it, but you see him, you watch him feed Ray Liotta his own brain. It's pretty intense.
Oh God, I'm definitely never watching it.
Yeah, it's like he's got like half a head, but he's like still kind of lucid, and he's like eating his own brain for dinner. It's kind of disgusting.
Asia, that's not possible, right?
I mean, you can't feel pain in your brain, so.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Because like,
it was just the top.
Yeah, so like theoretically, if his skull was cracked open. Like, open brain surgery is a thing. So, like, theoretically,
oh my God,
that could be possible.
Okay, we gotta move on. Should we talk?
Show that to Kate.
Quickly changing the subject off of eating brains. Want to also talk about Clarice and how strong of a character she is. I really loved how just of a like literal strong character she is in terms of not really wavering from Hannibal, fully always being committed to her goal. Like, she's really just presented as a strong, competent female FBI agent, to the point where actually female enrollment in the FBI went up after Signs of the Lambs went out. I don't know if it was intentional, like the FBI was trying to recruit people.
Yes, they were. That is why the FBI was very cooperative with their production and allowed them to shoot so much at Quantico, was for that exact reason, according to the documentary.
I was sold. I'd be a FBI agent, but then obviously I chose the psychology route.
Less active. You didn't have to run as much.
That's true.
Although Asia goes
it's okay.
to the gym every day.
Yeah, but I hate
Top
running.
Gun Maverick made me want to become a fighter pilot at 27, so, you know.
My uncle, after watching the original Top Gun, tried out for the Indian Air Force, and he was luckily rejected. but apparently it's like a thing. Anyway, we don't have to get into that. Sorry, we're talking about Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I definitely loved how like strong her character was, and it wasn't like an annoying like feminist way. It just felt very like natural and organic, mm-hmm. which I appreciated, even like in the midst of like all these men just kind of like staring at her, glaring at her, and doing all this stuff that's objectifying her. She like stood her ground, and like I think that because she was just so herself authentically, that they ended up respecting her in the end anyway.
Yeah, there's I love that point, right? Because she never, to like you said, she never like really makes strong feminist statements to point out what's happening. It's really more so through her actions and just being this strong, you know, heroine protagonist throughout the film. And there's a few scenes I feel like that really, really encapsulate that. And the one that sticks out in my mind is when she basically clears the room of all the cops when they're preparing to do the autopsy, right? Or even like when it's just her in the car, and he says to her, "Man, I really like hit a nerve with you back there that I said that." And it, you know, she pushes, and she's firm with him in that instance and pushes back.
Even with her being strong, I did appreciate how like we definitely did see moments where she did seem kind of just like very emotionally affected by what was going on with her. And like, I felt like it wasn't in a way where you thought of her character as weak. You just thought of her character as like, oh, like this is very human. Of course you're like gonna have these flashbacks to your father and like that grief that you're dealing with as you're like in a funeral home dealing with like the deaths and griefs of other people and families and things that they're dealing with. So I do think like her character was just so well written to be this like very strong woman that still was very like human at the end of the day. Like, it wasn't like, oh, she's a woman, of course she's gonna cry, you know? Yeah. It didn't feel like that.
I keep going back to the documentary, but it was just so insightful to see how everyone who made this film, what their thought processes are or were. And they talked a lot about how for Jodie Foster, who really pushed to get this role as Clarice Starling, she was not the first choice. It was actually Michelle Pfeiffer. But Jodie Foster, for her at the end of the day, all this film was about a woman trying to save the life of another young woman. And that was it, right? Like, sure, we can get into all of the deep complexities of this psychological thriller and her relationship with Hannibal and her treatment and her training at the FBI and her trying to make a career for herself. But really, at the end of the day, it's just this story about this woman trying to save another woman. And you could make the same exact story with a young male cop, and it is so much less effective, I think.
Well, I think part of it is because every time she goes anywhere alone, which, why is she alone?
Yeah.
But that's what you think. If it was a young male cop, you wouldn't really think, why are you alone? Get out of there. Like, having a woman in this circumstance is, unfortunately, because of how crime has just historically worked, makes you on edge whenever she's alone. And then when she survives those instances, it makes the point even more powerful.
Maybe she felt safe because she knew she wasn't the target.
And she felt like she was on Hannibal's level, which, respect, you know. Yeah. You know you've gotten an ally or a mentor or whatever their relationship is. I will say it really bummed me out how every other man, including Hannibal at times, is so disgusting to her. Like,
yeah.
And I guess I maybe that's how, I don't know how this got women to join the FBI, where they're just like, I guess if Clarice can take it, I can too. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like it's like you're a specific brand of person where you're just going to be like, okay, yes, this objectification exists, but I'm going to persevere and not care and do my own thing, which is like very much her persona. Even though like you could tell she cared a little bit, but she didn't let it like interfere with like her own personal career goals.
Okay, so as I mentioned like 10 separate occasions now, I watched the DVD extras, and there were about 40 minutes of deleted scenes from the film. Some of them were just scenes that were already in the film, but they were expanded a bit more, and the dialogue was more dragged out, or they were scenes, for instance, when she goes into the storage facility, right? And she goes in there alone, rather than what we see in the film where it's like completely silent and it's just her observing. There's a lot more dialogue in that same exact scene that they shot previously of like her calling back and forth to the old guy that's waiting outside. So there are scenes like that, but there are completely, you know, full scenes that are just nowhere to be found in the film. There's one scene where it shows a lot more of her training at the FBI, her doing a lot of the shooting training, which for me watching it really relates back to when she does kill Buffalo Bill and puts like 3 shots in his chest. It's pretty much her just doing that on a dummy at the FBI.
I would like to see that. In general, having the FBI sequences, like at one point I forgot about the FBI. Asia and I were watching the movie together, and I'm like, is somebody behind her getting arrested? She was like, it's a drill. And I was like, oh yeah. But yeah. It did keep like the background constantly entertaining, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite deleted scenes was they showed the ambulance in the tunnel driving erratically, like swerving lanes, and then they cut to him driving it and wiping blood off his face.
That's pretty great.
I would have loved that.
Oh, that scene. Yeah, I'm disappointed they caught that one. That one was probably my favorite one. One of the strangest ones was like 10 minutes long. It was a significant portion of these deleted scenes. And it was the Bible preacher program that Dr. Chilton is forcing Hannibal to watch. It's really just on the TV in the background, right? But one of the deleted scenes was just like the full sort of monologue of that show of what he would have been listening to. I don't know.
Was it like especially creepy or something?
No, I think it's probably just what they shot to put on that TV, and they were showing it as part of the deleted scenes. I don't know, you know, in what other circumstance they would have used it in the film.
Did you say it was 10 minutes long?
It was long. Oh my God. Like I couldn't even pay attention to it.
I feel like it was just coverage that they shot that they were like, can release this as a deleted scene.
But I feel like might be intentional. I can't think of like an older movie reference that does that, but I know, I think it was in Pearl or something. Yeah, I think it was Pearl where, like, I think one of the last scenes in the movie is just, like, very way too long scene of a TV of a preacher, like, doing a sermon. So I feel like it's, like, a horror trope of, like, the dichotomy of, like, sinister beliefs and, like, religion.
And just like probably the longer it goes on, the more unnerved the audience gets. Like, yeah, why am I sitting here watching
this? It was hard
to
watch. Oh, there's a good scene where Clarice is suspended from the FBI, from the academy.
Going out alone?
Basically, no, for making the deal. In the name of the senator. And so there's like, it's kind of a dragged out scene where they're fighting over like with the, which we do see the head of the FBI at some point in the film, but this scene is where they're really fighting over who, when like the new guy comes in to take over and they take Clarice off the case. And then, you know, further along, there's like scenes where she's talking to Jack and they're like kind of conniving, and she's like, I gotta go check this out. And he's like, here, take some money, like, and hop on. It's like very like backdoor shenanigans,
yeah,
type of stuff.
It seems like unnecessary, like, oh, we need to strengthen why Clarice will be so invested in finding Buffalo Bill. But when it reached the cutting room floor, they were like, no, like, we know. We don't need to include this.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, I guess, like, paints a little more color as to how they get to the end point where, like, she's off on her own investigating, and he's, like, ready to go in with the SWAT team. And just, like, how she gets there, I guess. Two more to mention. One, Clarice gets the drawings that she brings to Hannibal. She gets those like in a little drive-by with Barney. Jack tells her, bring him something, he'll be more likely to talk to you. And then she like meets up like with Barney, like, outside the institution and gets the drawings and drives off.
Who's Barney?
Barney is the guy who works the gate. Who, like, okay, he's like, you're going to do just fine. Like, and he's
the one other black person in the movie.
Yes. although, significantly, I will say another very quick tidbit. When Dr. Chilton is talking to Hannibal, when he's all tied up in the gurney and Hannibal's eyeing the pen, let's just talk about it. How did he get the pen, right? And that didn't really stick out to me until this viewing, that it actually, like, bothered me. I was like, how does he get his hands on that pen, right? Because the pen is how he later unlocks the handcuffs way down the line.
Wait, I thought, because Asia told me, so it's Asia's fault if I'm wrong, that he unlocks the handcuffs using a paperclip that he got from the case file that Clarice gave him.
I think it's a piece from the pen. It didn't look like a paperclip to me.
I mean,
it could be.
He was eyeing pens.
And they seed the pen so brilliantly with the doctor saying, like, oh, I can't find my pen. And they're like, oh, just use one of mine. So it definitely is intentionally trying to draw you to the pen.
Yeah.
I just thought there was another additional layer.
Yeah,
I
feel like it was like he had been plotting this way to escape since that moment. And the pen kind of, like, ignited that idea. And then I think Clarice probably didn't realize she left a pen or a paperclip or something in the case files. And as he was looking through them, he sees the opportunity. And
yeah. Well, so one of the theories is that he gets the pen from Barney. Because Barney's kind of like, Barney's kind of nice to him. He's like not, he's like one of the only people I think Hannibal kind of gets on with. And in that scene when Dr. Chilton was like, you're never getting out of here, I've called off your deal or whatever, at the very end of that, he whispers, Barney. Very easy to miss. You don't even see Barney on screen, but one of the deleted scenes is just from further back, and you see Barney in the foreground when he whispers his name. Doesn't show him giving him the pen or anything, but that is a fan theory that is out there. And then lastly, and I think one of the scenes that could have made it into the film is Jack Crawford going to Johns Hopkins to try and get a list of people who have been denied for sex reassignment surgery. And he's really getting into a heated argument with one of the doctors who is refusing to give up the names, and the doctor's really pushing back at him and saying, you know, like, we're not going to let you invade our patients' privacies like this. Transsexuals are nonviolent. And so that scene, I think, could have made it into the film, because for me, that was one of the most stark instances of pushing back against that narrative of, you know, of transsexuals being violent offenders, you know, which I know we're going to talk about as being a trope in horror films specifically. And, you know, I think that could have been a scene where they could have maybe hammered that home a little bit more.
Honestly, I think that deleted scene would have been super helpful, because it does feel like overall the representation of transsexuals that this movie portrays is really harmful. I think it's already super weird how throughout the movie they're just questioning whether this man is indeed trans or not. Like, that itself feels harmful. And then there are moments where Clarice and Hannibal point out that trans people are nonviolent. But I was reading this Vox article that basically said, when people think of Buffalo Bill, they don't remember Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter clinically discussing how he's not transgender. They remember how, as a Vox critic at large, Emily Vandervoort, recently pointed out on Twitter, a weirdo serial killer dancing around in women's clothes. And, like, that is, I think, the most disturbing thing for me, is that, like, oh, it's like, look at this villain, look how scary he is, and also, he likes to wear women's clothes. Doesn't that make him scarier? Which, I don't watch a lot of horror movies, so for this depiction especially stuck out to me, but Asia has unfortunately revealed to me that it is very, very common.
Yeah, like, I feel like in general, like, horror does tend to villainize people and their sexualities, like, even outside of, you know, being queer. It's if you are a woman that's sexual, like, you're also a villain, or like, you're gonna die first and stuff like that. So I feel like it's definitely like
the woman in Jaws gets eaten because she's having sex.
Yeah, almost every in all of like Friday the 13th. That's the whole plot. So it's just like unfortunate that it is such like a fun genre, but also at the same time, there's definitely like the issues with like how it does handle certain tropes and groups that are impacted by these harmful tropes kind of being perpetuated throughout the years.
Yeah, 100%. I watched Friday the 13th part 2 last week on Friday the 13th, and I texted on Kate's birthday in honor of her. She's a big fan. But I texted my friend who actually is a big fan of those films, and I was just like, biggest giveaway is the second a woman is topless in that film, you know, she's going to be dead within like 5 minutes.
When did the second Friday the 13th come out?
I don't know.
Recently or like many years ago?
Many years ago.
No, long. Yeah. Sorry, I don't know anything about horror movies. There's a ton of those.
But I feel like it's happening less now. And now to the point I feel like people are almost commenting on it, right? And like,
yeah.
I think we also have a lot more of like queer and women filmmakers that are like making a point to like, hey, horror can be this genre without, you know, doing this. But I definitely like the OG Halloween, you know, classics like that do really emphasize that trope.
Yeah. And we mentioned Norman Bates earlier, and one of the articles I read really like claimed that to be the start of this trope within the horror genre. In the Buffalo Bill, you know, instance is a really, I think, really peculiar one. And obviously, like, there's no beating around the bush of why it's problematic. And watching it in 2023, it certainly sticks out. But it was even problematic back then. And I think it's worth noting that there were protests like the night of the Oscars. And there was obviously, you know, back then, this wasn't as big of an issue. And even when I was watching the documentary, somebody mentioned like back then, not as many people even knew what LGBTQ stood for. But even with that limited awareness, you know, 30 years ago, there were still people that were aware that it was problematic. And, you know, I think something that's interesting is, you know, for years afterwards, Jonathan Demme, you know, apologized for that portrayal. And, you know, a lot of the people that were involved were very insistent on they tried to make that or they tried to disconnect the fact that he wasn't actually transgender. But like the article, Shruti, I think we probably read the same one. Like the article mentions, it doesn't really matter if he is, or like they're trying to like make this point that like, well, he actually wasn't, you know, we're just, but like the fact that it's even coded, that's all that matters, because that's what people are going to remember at the end of the day.
Yeah. And ultimately, like, it's, you know, erasing this whole idea that like he could be trans, and like ignoring that or erasing that, like that whole identity, like, just kind of doesn't make sense, because his whole motive is killing women, and so he could become one, or like, you know, wear their skin. So it's like, I don't know.
At the same time, it's also tricky, because the film is like partially based in reality, right? Like, I don't think, and granted, I don't know, I'm not the person who wrote the book or made the movie, so I don't want to claim to have known what was in their mind, but the character of Buffalo Bill is based off of, he's kind of this amalgamation, right, of several different serial killers. Ted Bundy, for one, Ed Gein, and Ed Gein very notably wore his mother's clothes when he was committing these murders, and I think they took inspiration from that. So I don't want to say, like, that they didn't intentionally want to villainize.
There's a third, sorry to cut you off. There's a third
The guy with the dungeon.
Yeah, exactly. That yeah. built a dungeon the same way Buffalo Bill did. So yeah, they are definitely borrowing from like famous murderers.
Yeah. But nevertheless, you know, representation matters and portrayal matters, and I think it's a very fair point to make, and it's you know, it's a criticism I think you have to go into the film acknowledging and have to acknowledge upon rewatches.
I think you also like can consider the fact that there is a bit of an undertone with the Christianity, like we were talking about earlier, with like the preacher like in the background on the TV, and I feel like part of that is kind of like dive into like the idea that like, oh, you can like pray away like mental illness or like stuff like that. And so I feel like that kind of goes hand in hand with like the thought that people have that like, you know, being of a certain sexuality is like also a mental illness, which like ridiculous, but like I think that's just kind of like that religious undertone coupled with like how certain religious groups think about people of different, you know, sexualities doesn't really like help be a positive space for like that to thrive in, you know.
Mm-hmm. The Silence of the Lambs is based off of a novel, but it's actually not the first novel even in the series. The first novel that features the character Hannibal Lecter was Red Dragon, and that was the inspiration for the film Manhunter by Michael Mann. Yes, and that is takes place in a, I guess, I'm just going to break down these sequels and prequels based off of, like, pre- or post-capture, right? We have three Hannibal Lecter timelines, essentially, right? Pre-arrest, arrest, and then escape.
Having his friends for dinner.
Having an old friend for dinner. So Manhunter takes place while Hannibal Lecter is in jail, and in this film, Hannibal Lecter is played by Brian Cox, who gives a great performance, although he's no Anthony Hopkins, I'll tell you that. And it also features FBI agent Will Graham, who is a main character within the Hannibal Lecter universe. You see him in a lot of other prequels and sequels, although not notably in The Silence of the Lambs itself.
Who do you think would win in a fight, Brian Cox or Anthony Hopkins? I think Brian Cox is the only one that would fight. Anthony Hopkins would be like, oh, no.
I don't know. Like, just them as humans?
Yes, them as humans.
Brian Cox, I think. Anthony Hopkins is a gentleman.
Yeah. Okay, fair. Sorry. Continue.
Which, by the way, might sound weird, but like, I think that's what makes his performance as Hannibal Lecter so good, is how he is charming and he is sophisticated. And it's like, as long as I'm not the one being eaten, I would fucking love to have him as a dinner guest. I'll tell you that. Like, there's something that you're just drawn to him.
I don't know. I don't want to be around him.
I'm drawn to him. And so
I am notably drawn to the creepy metaphor. So
that's true.
But so we,
Asia's ideal dinner conversation would be Hannibal Lecter and the clown from It.
Oh God.
And Michael Myers.
Nice. It's a great trio. But so then we have The Silence of the Lambs with Anthony Hopkins, and then we have two other films also starring Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter. We have Hannibal, which came out in 2001. And this takes place after.
This is where he feeds the brains.
No, I think that's Red Dragon.
Oh. Okay.
That's
sorry.
Red Dragon, yeah. Hannibal is after he escapes. This takes place 7 years later. He's in Italy. You know, he loves Florence, he loves the Duomo, he draws it in his cell. But this is after he escapes. Sadly, they could not get Jodie Foster to come back and play Clarice Starling. They replace her with Julianne Moore, who I like Julianne Moore, but it just doesn't work in this film.
Yeah.
They also have Gary. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. This is when he feeds his brain. Ray Liotta's in the cast of this. Sorry, I had my films crossed.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure you said Animal, like, the sequel. Because you said I was never going to watch it when you originally
Yeah, I couldn't
it.
Remember which one it was. Sorry. And then Gary Oldman is one of the main characters in this, and he...
Damn, they've got some great
So he has a very interesting role. He plays a Hannibal victim that survived. So he's all, like, fucked up looking.
Oh.
Yeah, like... no. Like, Hannibal kind of ate him, but he didn't die. So that film, it's a bit of a dud. Essentially, like, the best thing about it is Anthony Hopkins and his performance. And although, like, his performance in Silence of the Lambs is unreal, like, it is not the only thing that makes that film great. Like, it's the whole film is great. And, like, if the only good thing about the film is Anthony Hopkins, it's just not enough. And then there's Red Dragon. That stars Edward Norton as Will Graham. And in this one, Anthony Hopkins is in jail again. I think Hannibal's in jail, and Will Graham needs his help profiling, trying to catch the killer Ralph Fiennes. Or Fiennes,
Ooh.
Yes. They do get great casts for these.
Yeah.
I think... And Harvey Keitel. And Philip Seymour Hoffman. Oh, my God.
Wow.
In between the second and the third, Hannibal gets captured again.
So one is just a prequel, and then one is a sequel.
Oh,
there's no rhyme or reason to these release orders. And then there's another film, Hannibal Rising. That apparently, I haven't seen it, but that apparently goes back all the way to when he was a kid in Lithuania. the cast is the same, but it is the same production company. All four films are Dino De Laurentiis. And then we have the shows.
And then there's the show. Well, I wanted to talk specifically about the Clarice show, because that only went one season. And it seemed like there was a specific Silence of the Lambs point of view. But when I first heard about that they were doing it, I was like, oh, they're just making a police procedural and taking this IP to make it a little bit more interesting. Obviously not interesting enough to go more than one season.
Yeah.
But, like, when it comes to all of these...
Well, it got lost in the whole Paramount Plus thing.
But was it good?
I didn't see it.
So, I mean, I guess it wouldn't...
I read on Wikipedia that it kind of got lost in that transition.
Bob Backish, what did you do? Anyway, I just think that, like, Hannibal and Clarice both seem like... Oh, let's just pick these characters and throw them into this other thing because Silence of the Lambs made so much money. Because it seems to, from your descriptions, that these other spinoffs and sequels and movies and shows definitely just, like, felt half-baked, right?
Yes. So, Manhunter, which comes out before Silence of the Lambs, completely separate. Yeah. Manhunter is good. Silence of the Lambs is by far the best. The prequel and the sequel film stink. But Hannibal the show with Mads Mikkelsen playing Hannibal Lecter is fantastic. Very good show. That went three seasons. That was actually good.
So do you think there's going to be another Hannibal project in the works soon?
Oh gosh. I don't know. I don't really know the source material that well. I don't know if there's other books to go off of, but if it's somebody just being like, hey, let's revive this Hannibal Lecter, you know, and make our own story, I'm not here for it. I also really, I mean, unless you're getting Mads Mikkelsen to play Hannibal Lecter, I don't want it. Because in my opinion, he's, you know, outside of Anthony Hopkins, who is Hannibal Lecter, he's amazing. Mads Mikkelsen did a very good job, I think, in the show. And I don't trust many other actors to take on this role, to be honest.
It looks like there is a period pilot in development at Apple with fifth season attached to make another Hannibal series. The Life of Hannibal at Carthage is the synopsis of the show, according to the database I'm looking at. So Wouldn't you know it, there's another one in the works. I guess we knew that was coming.
Let's hope it never gets made.
I mean, if it's good, I trust Apple.
I like
Apple.
Yeah,
if Hannibal was good, yeah. Like, I'm not, like, people are like, oh, scrounging for IP. Like, I'm not opposed to it if it's good, but, like, use a purpose. Like The Last of Us. Take the IP and build it into such a brilliant word that you're actually doing something additive.
Yeah.
Instead of just making a police procedural with Clarice.
Yeah.
Did you know there was a Silence of the Lambs musical?
Silence the musical.
Oh, God. No, I did not.
It is literally called Silence! Exclamation point, the musical. Were you making a joke?
No, I knew that.
I thought you should have just made an incredible joke. We're running a little short on time, so I'm not going to look up a song, but I will cut in some audio from the musical here because y'all just need to know how ridiculous the IP machine is.
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It does this when it's told. It rubs the lotion on its skin, or else it gets the hose. And when it's done, there's one more thing, a simple little task. It's put the fucking lotion in the basket. Put the fucking lotion in the basket. All these stupid women are the same.
So the Silence of the Lambs performed very well at the Oscars. It completed the quote-unquote big sweep, which is winning all five major awards, which are Best Director, Best Picture, Lead Actor, Lead Actress, and Adapted / Original Screenplay, whichever one it is eligible for. There's been a whole slew of films, 40-some-odd, that have been nominated for the big sweep, but only three historically have actually pulled off the feat. It happened One Night by Frank Capra. That was the seventh Academy Awards, a very, very old film. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which Shruti, you mentioned earlier, because Nurse Ratched also won an Oscar for that film. And then The Silence of the Lambs was the last film 30 years ago, or even more than that now, 32, to complete the big sweep, which is no small achievement.
Well, okay, I just want to point out that Everything Ever All at Once just didn't have a lead actor, but it won picture, director, writing, supporting actress, actress, and supporting actor.
Well, it's not a big sweep.
But they didn't have it eligible.
It's a bigger sweep. Yeah, I know. No, you're right.
It was if it was going to happen to any movie, I'm happy it happened to Everything Ever All at Once because that movie is brilliant. But going forward, I would love the Academy to spread the love a little
Well, more. And there's certainly, right, there's films out there that have won more than five Academy Awards. You have films that have won double-digit Academy Awards, like Lord of the Rings. But Lord of the Rings didn't really have many acting nominees outside of Ian McKellen. But I digress. It was very successful at the Oscars. Shruti and I, we were texting the other day. Something really interesting was that this film came out in February and then had to wait all the way until the following March.
It came out on Valentine's Day.
What a great...
How romantic.
What a great... You know what? Now that I...
A date with Hannibal.
Now that I think about it, I think my grandparents went to see it.
Oh my God,
and
really?
Yes, and I think they had to leave because my grandfather had like food poisoning. Like he was like throwing up and they left.
Oh, yeah, no. The cannibalism probably disturbed
Probably,
him.
But I think my grandmother went back the next day to watch it.
Iconic.
But, you know, it went over a full year until the following Oscars and still, you know, had that much buzz about it to win. And then I started like researching what other films, you know, is it the longest wait that there ever was? I mean, there's a lot of talk about Everything Everywhere that came out in March and basically went a full calendar year and was able to keep the buzz going. Does not hold the record, I hate to say.
Oh.
Yes, The Greatest Show on Earth went slightly longer. I think that came out in January and went to March. And then there's some other older films like Casablanca and Sound of Music.
Ah, that doesn't count.
I mean, back when, like, the Oscars, the schedule was a lot weirder back then. And even, like, yeah, the very first Oscars, they did it, like, 2 years at a time. So it definitely was a bit wonkier back in the day. But in modern times, speaking of, like, having this tried and true, like, Oscar season, it's definitely one of the longest periods from release date to Oscar victory.
I heard on a podcast that between the release of Silence of the Lambs in February and its win the following year, that summer is when Jeffrey Dahmer got arrested.
Oh.
And that, their theory, this is the Unspooled podcast, great podcast to get all of your film history from. Their theory was that, like, that put serial killers back into the conversation, which helped Silence of the Lambs. They're basically saying that Silence of the Lambs owes their victory to Jeffrey Dahmer. No, that's not what they were saying, but I think it is interesting to, you know, track trends and think, oh, maybe if that hadn't happened, it wouldn't have blown up as much. I don't know. Who's to say?
I don't know. I feel like it's a true test of the quality of a film, and I feel like the Silence of the Lambs did really, like, you could tell there's a lot of effort put into, like, the production, the casting, the script. Like, the effort was put in. I think it does, like, play a role. And even with Everything Everywhere All at Once, like, that's another thing where it's, like, you know, you can tell a lot of effort and thought was put into it, even though, you know, didn't get a big sweep for, you know, technicality reasons. But, like, I feel like regardless of, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer being arrested, the effort was put there, and I feel like that showed and pushed it through, like, the whole year.
Yeah. Granted, I wasn't alive to watch this Oscars, but part of me, like, almost wonders how expected, you know, these wins were for the Silence of the Lambs, and if it really was almost a given on Oscar nights. Just because, like, I've went back and I've watched the clips of, you know, them winning. And I don't know, you get this sense that almost, like, everyone in the room expected it to happen anytime they announced these, you know, the film winning the award, or Anthony Hopkins or Jodie Foster winning the award. I mean, even, like, I've watched the intro to that Oscars, and Billy Crystal, who hosted, he gets rolled out, like, on, like, in the mask and in the straitjacket, like, from the start of the show. So
one of the podcasts I was listening to seemed to seemed to connote that JFK was really the front runner, and I would just counter argue the Billy Crystal thing in that Ben Stiller came out the year Avatar came out in full Navi Avatar wardrobe when Avatar wasn't even nominated. Yeah. So sometimes it's just, like, the buzzy thing. Like, I don't know if that necessarily says that's the winner. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
But it definitely was the buzzy thing. Like, people were talking about it, so that could mean people thought it was going to win. I don't know. Let's make a time machine. Or we could just ask somebody that was alive.
Yeah, that's still
a thing. A lot of those people are still alive. If you were alive...
Hey, do you remember the 91 Oscars?
Email us, chaosonsetpod@gmail.com, with your memories of the 1991 Oscars. Good. Well, on that note, let's wrap things up on this spooky episode of Chaos on the Set. Aisha, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have anything to plug? You don't need to, but sometimes people plug their Letterboxd or their Twitter or a mental health hack that you have.
I'm not currently having any projects on social media, so I will not plug that. But take care of your mental health.
Yes.
As a advocate for that, I think it's very important. I think there was a week this month that was actually Mental Health Awareness Week. Just, you know, go to therapy, friends.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to think of something clever to say because, you know, normally if Kate was here, then she would say something like, you know, I can't share my letterbox because then Michael would, like, make me swallow my own tongue or some, you know, disgusting. She really would have had a good one for this episode, but I'll just say,
honestly, I'll say it here because Kate won't listen to it. I think Kate has been slacking.
She's been caught off guard a couple of times.
Hits.
Yeah.
Yeah. There have been some, I'm like, Kate, you should obviously have said this one,
but like,
okay,
this movie is really a softball when it comes to some vile things. But yeah, you can follow me on Letterboxd at M Riccardi. And until next time, I hope you enjoy some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Got it. Hope you guys that didn't have headphones in and have to hear that inside your brain. But anyway, you can follow me on Twitter at MicroMrate. You can follow me on Letterboxd at TrithiMrate. And then you can follow our show. We're on Twitter, Instagram, on Letterboxd. All of those are at Chaos on the Set. And then we also have a Gmail again. Send us all of your thoughts. ChaosOnTheSetPod@gmail.com. We're going to be covering Our Flags Mean Death Season 2 soon. We're going to be covering Lost up to Season 2, Episode 15. So any thoughts you have on that or on the 1991 Oscars, send those into us, chaosonthesetpod@gmail.com.